Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Negotiation Podcast. I'm your host, Todd Embley. And on today's show, we welcome Lisa Nan, beauty editor at Jing Daily. She joins the show to break down what's really happening in China's beauty and luxury markets right now. From the rise of C-beauty brands challenging international players to the unexpected virality of Kris Jenner as China's money goddess, Lisa tracks the trends that are reshaping how brands sell in the world's largest beauty market. Lisa talks about the hottest brands and the subcategories driving growth, the emergence of male beauty and the silver beauty market, the 50-plus consumers, and the decline of mega anchors in China's live streaming ecosystem. She explains which domestic and foreign brands are winning, what's replacing the mega anchor model, and how moments like the Winter Olympics and viral memes reveal deeper shifts in Chinese consumer behavior. Lisa also discusses the current state of China's overall beauty and luxury markets, functional beauty trends like scalp care and science-backed skin care, and the emerging developments international brands should be monitoring closely. Whether you're a brand considering China entry or navigating the market's rapid evolution, this conversation offers actionable insights from one of the industry's sharpest observers. Enjoy.
So I think for years and even now, the China beauty industry has been courting Gen Z trend cycles on all the use-driven categories. But they really neglected this such a huge market. Just to give some data, China State Information Center shows that the country's silver economy has reached 8.3 trillion RMB in 2024, roughly $1.2 trillion. And by 2030, that number is going to grow to 20 trillion RMB, $3 trillion. This is a huge population, and their spending power is also good because they are retired, they don't have any loans anymore, and they can spend that money however they want. They don't have any other thoughts, that their kids have grown up. According to Alibaba, actually, silver beauty GMV reached 44.1 billion RMB in 2024. And according to the survey, consumer age from 50 to 70 indicate that 100% of them use skincare products.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to the Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Lisa, welcome to the Negotiation Podcast.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for having me, Todd. It's a pleasure.
Yeah, you're welcome. It's good to have you. Where does the podcast find you today?
Here I am in Florence, Italy.
Yes, I know. I'm so jealous. I have said for, years, if not decades, I want to retire in Italy. And so I've never been. I just, for some reason, want to be there. So I'm jealous. And one of these days, when I'm ready, I will pick your brain about the best place in Italy to go. I'll ask you right now, if I wanted to retire to Italy, where should I go retire to in Italy?
Wow, so many beautiful places. But one place I want to retire is Capri Island.
It's Capri Island.
Yeah, such a beautiful island in the south of Italy.
Done. Okay. Well, that's location one. I've already got it in the pocket. All right. Thank you. Let's start with the big picture. How would you characterize the state of China's beauty market right now? Is it strong? Is it weak? And what are the main dynamics shaping the market in 2026?
I think it's hard to define in one word. The demand is actually still there, but the consumption scenario has changed a lot in China. So the whole purchase making factor has completely changed. The market enters a much more mature phase, let's see. Just to give some data, this year actually it has performed quite well. In the first 2 months of 2025, China cosmetic sales was 4.5% up year on year. But we have to know that within that growth, competition is kind of intensifying for market shares. Consumers are increasingly prioritizing ingredients and overall price competition is also squeezing players' margins, especially on marketing budgets. This is a high expander in China. And then I would say that compared to the last decade, structurally, there will be a slower growth because the market is no longer driven by rising income and first-time luxury consumption. Consumer decision-making is really influenced by ingredients, by efficacy, and then lately by brand. So this is completely different from the past decade where brand heritage could kind of dictate the consumption. In this scenario, it means that even ultra-luxury brands, high-end beauty brands, are competing in the same space. They have to prove that their products are effective. They can really deliver visible results. This is a very competitive market.
That it is. We definitely know that about China. Now, what about the overall luxury market in China? We've seen mixed signals in brands cutting stores. Others are doubling down. What's your read on where luxury stands right now?
I think in terms of cutting stores, we really need to look at what kind of stores are being cut. So from 2019 to 2023, in 5 years' time, beauty counters were cut by 6,000 stores. The numbers were 15,000 beauty counters in 51 cities in 2019, and it was slashed to 9,500 in 2023. So we lose more than 6,000 beauty counters. But the beauty counter's actual use is just to sell a product. Instead, on the other hand, we are seeing brands investing in massive flagship stores. Even C-beauty brands that used to rely on online sales, they are investing in flagship stores because this is where brands can pour all their resources and create an immersive space that not only sell the products to the final consumer, but also educate the consumer. They can help them to understand not only the products, their functionalities, but also to understand about the brand, so to create a loyal customer. We often say that nowadays brands should not measure stores by footprint per sales, because oftentimes consumers are inspired by offline stores because they experience the brand there, but then the actual purchase happens online. So this means that store still is a very important touch point, but it has shifted from a pure transactional space into a social engagement space, which is particularly important for Gen Z consumers that really want to experience the brand. That makes a total difference.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've seen that across a lot of different sectors. Whether it's, you know, sports apparel or what have you, I think it's about the opportunity to build an experience with the brand, for the brand to be able to build an experience and a relationship with their market. It's not necessarily a, you know, point of sale anymore, as you said. Now, you recently published, speaking of C-beauty, you recently published an A to Z guide to C-beauty brands, and you've been tracking international players closely. Which domestic brands and which foreign brands are the hottest right now in China, and what is driving their success?
This is a really hard question. I really can't tell which one is the hottest. They are like doing awesomely in their respective realm. But to mention a few brands like Proya, they became the first Chinese brand to cross the 10 billion RMB annual sales, annual revenue in 2025. This is the first brand to do so. So it already indicates how successful they are in the Chinese market, how much they sell. And another brand is the high-end cosmetics brand, Mao Ge Ping, that is also one of the first pushing for IPO in Hong Kong and getting listed there. It's quite hard, but we can see that C-Beauty is getting more and more structural and also ambitious, because Proya actually stated that they would like to become one of the top 10 beauty global beauty brands in a decade time. And this is also through aggressive acquisitions in fields that they are not mature yet. So they are definitely very, very ambitious. And for international brands, actually looking at the ranking charts, every time we have, all the GMV ranking charts during Double 11 and so on, I always spot the YSL sitting either on the top or top three. So I believe YSL is a very strong player in China's beauty market.
You know, I would think when I say, or somebody says, what's hottest, there's a difference between being hot and being popular. So we know and we can easily tell who's popular. What I'm thinking is who has the greatest percent rise in popularity. Now, we should set a minimum bar on that of some established popularity, so that you're not coming from 0 to 1 would look like a huge, on a percent growth basis, would be a huge number. But at a minimum level of popularity, do you see any brands locally or domestic that you're kind of keeping an eye on? Like, they're not big yet, they're not super popular yet, but man, they're growing fast. Anything that you can point to that would fall into that category?
Yeah, I think one brand that it's been under my radar, but it's not like China specific. I would say like it's a C-beauty brand, but they are doing amazingly overseas, and that really surprised me, is Flower Nose. So Flower Nose aesthetic is very fairy tale driven aesthetic, very feminine. It's even over decorated, but because of this appealing aesthetic, it's getting a massive popularity abroad. And I think this concept can really outgrow its business in China. You know, their US market, their European market, and the Southeast Asia market could be even bigger than China. And this also points to a trend that C-beauty brands are all trying to export their products overseas. They all want to be successful also overseas, because China is becoming very saturated and very price competitive. Instead, it's a really good blueprint player, Flower Nose, to show to Chinese beauty brands how to be successful overseas. So I think it's a kind of dark horse.
That's exactly what I was looking for. I want to ask you another question off script. What, or do you think that a positioning of ultra feminine does well in China?
That's a really good question. It does, actually, because right now we speak a lot about female empowerment, and in China, it does make sense. Females are really kind of really empowered nowadays, but this concept work because the concept of self-love, self-respect is very popular in China, and it links back also to emotional marketing. So this kind of purchasing a product because you kind of want to gratify yourself does work. And using this ultra feminine concept, it can work, but you really need to be very careful because the silver line is ultra thin. You can, it can be also a backlash as well. So it really means how you cross the line, because Proya has always used marketings that have been ultra feminine, like empowering female consumers, looking at even motherhood and all these concepts. But yeah, it also happened that they crossed the red lines. So we really need to be very careful with these concepts.
Now, beyond brands, what are the hottest subcategories in beauty right now? You've written about scalp care, fragrance, functional beauty. What's actually selling and why are these categories taking off?
I'm quite even direct when I speak. I think now the skinification of niche segment is particularly relevant in the industry because everything is saturated. All the segments are saturated. Companies need to invent something, invent a need that consumer didn't know they had. They have to invent it to find the new growth opportunities. So this is why, it wasn't enough just washing hairs or treating well the hairs. It was born that the concept of a healthy scalp would make your hair glow, right? So we have a scalp care, and then even the skinification of body care. So we see that everything, it's like a second face. Your neck, your foot, your hands, there is a mask for everything. And then even fragrance, we have now home scents. But I think the influence of COVID has also played an important role here because we were spending more time at home and we wanted to bring that spa level of treatment at home and really kind of enjoy that time. So we would buy home scents, sophisticated devices, scrub, massage tools, all the masks, just to recreate that spa experience, right? So I think, once again, all these products actually surround this concept of emotional marketing because the actual product they sell is more beneficial to your emotion than the actual functionality itself. It brings you joy by purchasing it. We are in a very lonely society, actually. There is a rising singlehood. People are very stressed by the grueling 996 work hours. And there is also lots of social pressures about marriage, having children. So we really want to treat ourselves and find this place where we can spend a bit money and then receive joy in exchange.
All our best friends are people we've never met and we only know their usernames from their Discord. It's interesting. And you said it, there's a mask for everything. At some point, we're just going to be going snorkeling in, moisture lotion or something like this. At some point, it's got something for everything. And I think it was a good call to say, at this point, because of the saturation, we're creating the problem and then driving the fear around the problem,
the anxiety,
so to speak.
Yeah.
And then now, but hey, don't worry. We also have a solution for you, and then sell. It's a bit of a treacherous circle.
Yeah.
Now, one trend you've covered is the growth of male beauty in China. how big is this opportunity? And how are brands approaching the male consumer differently than they did even a few years ago?
So this opportunity is huge. It's a billion-dollar market. And this is actually a topic I cover every year. But every year I found something new that kind of surprised me. I remember when at the very beginning I covered about it because I brought beauty into Gen Daily. It was really basic grooming, like people use the most basic moisturizer and face cleansing foam. That's all for male beauty. And that felt like already a huge step. But then the second year I covered it, it was already a 3-in-1 formula. So using the same amount of time but getting better results, a moisturizer that contained moisturizing and then sunscreen and BB cream. So you kind of had your makeup done as well. But then the following year, we see that the college students, the male college students were doing tutorials online, sharing beauty tips because they wanted to have a better looking during their university years, because this is when you date girls and so on. And then very fast, it became a really kind of it spread also among white collars, because they believed a better appearance actually could help them succeed in their career life, or people that were in their more senior age, they started to ask the help of makeup artists before dating a girl, so to give a good first impression. So it became more and more sophisticated. And right now what we see that is even light medical aesthetics and the non-invasive plastic surgery has become a trend among male consumers. And now these clinics actually that used to cater to female consumers, so more pinkish or more pastel colors, they have changed their wall into neutral colors to make sure that even male customer felt comfortable to go to these clinics and have more private rooms, so they didn't feel intimidated to be in these places or to be recognized by people. So I just I'm excited to find what's next, because every year I cover it, it's changing so fastly and it's so interesting.
Now, you've written about the silver beauty market, consumers 50 and older, of which I've already demonstrated I'm not even close to that age bracket, but also I am, which you say is finally taking off. What's driving this, and which brands are getting it right with older consumers?
So I think for years and even now, the China beauty industry has been courting Gen Z trend cycles, on all the youth-driven categories. But they really neglected this such a huge market. Just to give some data, China State Information Center shows that the country's silver economy has reached 8.3 trillion RMB in 2024.
We did it.
Roughly $1.2 trillion, and by 2030 that number is going to grow to 20 trillion RMB. Which is roughly 3 trillion dollars. This is a huge population, and their spending power is also good, because they are retired, they don't have any loans anymore, and they can spend that money however they want. They don't have any other thoughts. Their kids have grown up. So according to Alibaba, actually, silver beauty GMV reached 44.1 billion RMB in 2024. And according to the survey, consumer age from 50 to 70 in top tier cities indicate that 100% of them use skincare products. And 23% actually spend more than 4,000 RMB annually. So this is a very high number, even compared to usual young beauty consumers. And right now, I think it's a huge opportunity for brands because we now see more and more 60 plus content creators. Before, we didn't see this demographic, but they are like a vehicle. These influencers are real vehicles to educate consumers because really the senior consumer, sometimes they don't know their need, but because of this influencer, they can educate not only these consumers, but also their children. So really helping them to understand they have this need and the products they can buy. And what is interesting is that mature established brands are not capturing enough this trend. Instead, this is a trend more platform led because of this influencer, like on Douyin. They spend lots of time on Douyin. And actually, Douyin native brands are capturing this this demographic. We have Meishi, Kaweiduo, they are all Douyin native brands. They are doing massive sales online, capturing the needs of these senior consumers. Yeah, so I think this is a missed opportunity, and brands should invest more. There are brands trying. They try to enter this market, but maybe not in the right way. Douyin is really an important market to reach to this target. And they really need to look at the pain points of senior consumers because they have a skin health issue, not only just moisturizing or anti-aging and dark spots. Fighting, they have more serious skin issue that maybe we need to target a bit more. So it's really about investing in R&D and creating specific solution and not just considering them a side consumer. Then you will never be able to reach out to them.
Yeah, and technology around analysis, skin analysis, or scalp analysis, scanning, or hair analysis. Yeah. You know, that is also a big, big part of just health in general. As you get older, it just seems like you need to more and more often get yourself checked.
Yes.
And I know you might get your heart checked or some other things, but there's a lot, you know, kidneys and livers and gut health and things like you. We have to spend, as you cross 50, a lot more time. And so the diagnosis of certain things like your skin and your hair and stuff like this are just things more and more people want. And everybody wants to fight aging. Nobody loves to continue to look in the mirror and notice how old they're getting.
Exactly. And it really makes me think also the presence of brand, they need to change the channels they usually are present, like not in luxury department store, but more in hospitals and pharmacies, places where these consumers usually spend more time. I think, this is a really good spot.
So shifting to e-commerce and live streaming, okay, you've tracked the decline of mega anchors in China's live streaming market. What happened to the mega anchor model? And what's replacing it?
So I think this was an inevitable trend from the very beginning because brands want to take back control. It's always like this. Even luxury brands, they used to sell at multi-brand stores. But right now they are abandoning this system and they are focusing on their flagship stores because they cannot control their service, the quality, and the results. So a huge problem of how to deal with the customer, the after sales, and the data you lose actually by because they actually, for mega influencer, they not only spend lots of time to secure a spot in their live streaming, and then they have to give a margin percentage to these mega influencers, and also to buy traffic for these live streaming broadcast rooms. So to make sure that there is lots of people coming to join the session, all this money, actually, they could have spent it for their own channels and really kind of secure this customer, turn them into loyal customers through after sale and the CRM process. But by relying on mega influencers, all of that cannot be done. And yeah, it's a huge cost that they don't see a return. It's more a one-off purchase, and mostly it's relied on a very heavy discount system. This is something that brands can no longer support because it's really slashing their margins. It's not beneficial to the brand anymore. We do see that lots of brands actually are selling more in China, but their net profit is declining. This is really because of this live streaming room that are always battling for the lowest price, the deepest discount. But this is really unhealthy for brands, so they are kind of abandoning this system. Indeed, we see this year that in the first quarter of 2026, 85% of the top beauty brands on Douyin have reduced their reliance on influencer-led live streaming, some by even 20%. So it's a huge cut. And last year, like only 16 of the top 20 influencers surpassed the 100 million RMB GMV. Well, before they easily surpassed that number. So we really see a drastic shift in this sector. But this, as I said, it's inevitable, and it's only beneficial for brands to bring back those traffic to their own self-operated room. It's not without cost. It seems, they have to build the whole ecosystem. But I think this it's always money invested in the right way, because at the end of the day, it's owned by the brand itself.
I want to ask one more question in between, and we're going to get to the Kris Jenner meme here in a second. But I'm inspired to now ask, how is AI, given what you just said with the mega anchors and things like that, I want to ask about AI and how is AI potentially influencing all of this?
How is AI actually influencing?
I mean, could the just, you know, actual influencers being replaced by AI influencers? Or does it impact trust where AI filters are now representing non-truth, non-realistic, non-live actual look of products? Is that interrupting, potentially improving trust through live streaming or ads or things? I'm just curious, in this entire show of everything we're talking about, the AI effect.
I think there are lots of live streaming rooms that embed AI, because for a live streaming anchor, it's quite impossible to be there 24 hours. It's also a really heavy job, even staying there speaking for 4 hours.
Oh, imagine you and us doing this for 4 straight hours. Yeah, I mean,
I know. And that was at the Kering Capital Markets Day. And their CEO, Luca De Meo, actually presented for 4 hours straight. And I said, wow. But yeah, exactly. So there are lots of live streaming rooms that are 24 hours open, so people can keep asking questions. And there are lots of help of AI or these virtual anchors sitting here and answering to the most basic question, but even some sophisticated question they can answer. So this ensures that you can live stream whole day long. Of course, you cannot see the try on and the actual effect, but it does reply to some, it works like a customer service, right? So from this aspect, it's quite good. And then I was talking to Tmall. And what I found super interesting is their hyper segmentation for each brand, because the traffic pool sometimes during Double 11, all the luxury brands, for example, are competing for the same traffic pool. But what if AI can really help you identify different spots and your different advantages? Like in this price range, maybe there are less luxury brands competing in this price range. So I will use the help of AI to find the targets that wish to purchase products in this price range and push this target into your own live streaming room or official page or do advertising for them. So you really can secure targeted consumers without spending lots of money on the same SEO keywords and so on. So this is the effect of AI. Even for medium and small merchants, sometimes they don't have enough equipment to make product shootings and campaigns. But during Double 11, with the help of AI, they help them to all realize product shooting. Of course, this is a problem. Here comes the problem with trust. So there are lots of returns, but today we live in a world that it's really visual driven. So without a product image, you really a pretty product image, you really can't compete. And it does really help with small merchants because they don't have the tool, but this allow them to compete quite fairly with larger brand, bigger brands. Sometimes their quality, you don't know, maybe they are better.
Yeah. You know, you can look like a much bigger company and a much bigger brand than you actually are deploying AI. You know, we interviewed Dr. Nikki Sweeney a couple of weeks ago. She's the founder of AI Her Way. She was talking about even her own company. There's three women, human, that live or that work at the company, and they work a total of 40 hours a week. Yet they have 42 AI agents who do most of the heavy lifting that allow them to have such a low human capital investment into being able to run the company and be able to support so many of their clients, really with only three humans working a total of 40 hours a week. It's just a good example of AI again, and leveraging AI to actually compete with the big boys without actually being one of the big ones.
Yeah. But at the beginning, the training phase, it's so time consuming and it's crazy. And I see lots of companies are going through this phase, and the workers, actually employees, are facing the reality that they are teaching AI what they do and then being replaced with an AI that has their same name doing what they do and then being fired. So lots of time the amount of work maybe I don't say the specific example you've given, but in some companies, maybe it seems that AI did a lot, but the amount of work for workers actually has increased because they need to check, train the AI when before maybe this task was easily done by a human person and it was very quick and easy.
You can ask AI to almost deploy as your assistant, and then your assistant replaces you because it has learned everything. And it's not just like NIL, right? Name, image, likeness. It's name, image, likeness and personality and style. And, you know, it's adopting everything. Heck, the avatar might even just be a doppelganger for the person they just replaced.
A very interesting Weibo hot search last week or this week, I don't remember, is iQIYI, Chinese equal to Netflix in China. They announced that actually they signed an agreement with all the celebrities. They are going to create an AI avatar for them. So instead of producing 2 to 3 TV series per year, they can do up to 40s with their AI. This is so crazy. I don't know. It's going. AI is running so fast right now, and we really don't know how it's going to be used, and whether TV series with AI avatars or the actual celebrity will be different, but somehow it really go to the question also how new celebrities rise in that case. We just recognize the most influential one.
Oh, okay. So let's lower the anxiety around all of this right now. And let's talk about Kris Jenner, who's going viral as China's new money goddess.
Yes.
You wrote, a media personality's virality as a digital luck charm showing how Gen Z blends irony, ambition, and cultural fluency. What does this meme moment tell us about how Chinese consumers engage with Western celebrities and brand ambassadors?
So I think it's quite random how Chinese consumers engage with Western celebrities because they are not influenced by Western TV series or any shows because they don't have access to those because of the firewall, internet ban. So the way they get to know these celebrities is pretty random. And it takes its own path, so it's not controlled by anyone. And this is the interesting thing. So this is, Mimi, it's definitely not a Western trend, but a trend born in China and then exported to the Western world. So it's so interesting. And by accident, it just clashed with China's mysticism. Right now, Chinese young consumers are in this economic downturn, so they are quite mystic, and they are finding they are finding their spiritual wellness into temples, money goddess, really going to those temples that can secure fortune, or even with Lego creating your own money goddess at home. And then they really believe in feng shui, so having a plant here rather than there. So it's really interesting also how the beauty industry has reacted. I remember a brand, now I don't remember the name, Molton Brown, and they created a scent with a temple. So by spraying this scent, it actually can bring you good luck. So it's so interesting. Instead, in terms of ambassador, I think international celebrities just don't really resonate with local consumers. This is also why brands invest so much in local ambassadors, having Chinese celebrities as their ambassadors, because otherwise, by having international ones, Chinese people just doesn't know who they are. And they cannot tell their identity, brand identity through those personalities. Instead, they are very familiar with Chinese ones. So this is a really big difference. And a lot of Chinese ambassadors are actually getting international global titles. So
okay. Well, you've also covered how the Winter Olympics have influenced marketing in China, whether it's Eileen Gu, Su Yiming, enduring appeal, or the broader winter sports trend. How are brands leveraging winter sports and Olympic moments in their China strategies?
So we know that right now, Chinese consumers are highly proud of their own culture and country, especially with the younger generation, because they weren't born in an era that made in China was kind of equal to cheap products. Instead, they were born in the Guocao era, where C-beauty brands, all the Chinese products were kind of a cheaper but better substitute to international brands, right? So they just believe that in Chinese excellency. And the Olympic athletes, this event as big as Winter Olympics or even the Olympics themselves, this is a huge event on global stage. And by bringing gold home, there is no experience like more than would make you more proud than this kind of event, right? So it's really tapping on China's pride by leveraging these athletes and making them into brand ambassadors. And before, if we saw, we think lots of luxury brands had a backlash because of hiring some celebrity ambassadors that had some misconducts. These athletes actually can kind of balance the cast of brand ambassador, and they deliver very positive message, and they also bring on their shoulder the whole national pride. So by tapping them, it kind of links to this moment of of proudness. So it's very important for brands, actually. I think right now luxury brands have also to be very smart. I don't think they sign off the agreement at the moment they win the gold medal. They have to sign it before to secure them. So it's really
too expensive after.
Yeah, it's really a race, I think.
No, 100%. I mean, as much as there's scouts out there for professional sports teams looking for the next great talent, the brands are also doing the same. Because if they can land them early and then they rise to greatness, that was a much cheaper way to associate your brand with a very, very popular figure or influencer from whatever it is, sports or cinema or something like that. But catch them early and then you get to ride the wave as well. As we wrap up, what are the other big trends you're monitoring right now that international brands should be paying attention to? And what's emerging that might not be on everyone's radar yet?
Yeah, good question. I think with the China maxing trend, international brands should not only be cautious about Chinese brands in China, but also worldwide. For instance, CBD overseas export is growing for the fifth consecutive year. We also experienced the boom of Pop Mart's Labubu, electric vehicles, home tech devices, Xiaomi, Huawei, TCP. The threat and the competition may now begin in international brands' home country and not in China. So I really think brands need to have this under their radar because competition is intensifying not only in China but also abroad. They are finding their rival in their home countries and taking their market shares.
Lisa, this has been incredibly valuable. For our listeners who want to follow your coverage of China's beauty and luxury markets, where can they find you?
So on jingdaily.com, our English website.
Yeah, Jing Daily. That's J-I-N-G Daily, jingdaily.com, correct?
Exactly.
All right. And go look up Lisa Nan. That's Lisa Nan, beauty editor at Jing Daily. Thank you very much for joining us today. We really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much. I had a really enjoyable talk with you.
Okay. So for everybody that wants to interact with us, and I hope that you do, obviously that helps us. Give us a like, give us a follow, a subscription would be amazing. Or even hearing from you, you can reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co. But from me, from Lisa and everybody at the negotiation team, thank you very much for listening and or watching, and we will see you next time. Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@wpic.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.